I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Recently, I've been wondering how a person could possibly participate in the various public discussions about our collective future as a country without getting harmed along the way. There are stones, there are glass houses, there are extreme positions, there's egos, there's prima donnas, there's protesters and trolls and diatribes and logical fallacies, there's satires and send-ups, screeds, skeptics, you've got the whole mix. I haven't even mentioned yet journalistic op-eds. But for the most part, the average citizen who gets caught in the fray, in the culture war, if you will find the greatest exposure to verbal shrapnel, and we can be glad it's just verbal for the most part. We find this on social media platforms like Twitter or Facebook. It feels very much like a war zone out there. Can a person engage and come away unscathed? Most of us would say not. Well, has it ever been thus in the public sphere when we discuss our public policies and our future together? We are currently in a season of extreme tension, and what I find fascinating is that so many of us think this is unique to our times, to our generation. Well, it's not. I would say that disunity is actually the norm, even in a place that calls itself the United States. And I'm not touting the merits of discord and division. I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying we've been here before. It may just be that the platforms have changed, and the speed of information, of course, has accelerated. Well, a case in point is the divisive nature, even within a political movement such as abolition. Talking about our past history, it is too easy to think that a common cause is going to result in common approaches to trying to address a social ill if things were only so simple. They're just not. If you're all on the same side, wouldn't you find a way to get along and to find common strategies? Well, here to tell us the story of a great divergence of strategy in the history of abolition in pursuing a common cause is H.W. Brand. Bill Brands has been with us before in the discussion of the American frontier. It's great to have him back. He's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, has written more than a dozen biographies and histories. And today we're going to tap into his volume titled The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. Bill Brands, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you again, Marcus.
You know, the John Brown character is somebody that I remember from my school days. I think I was probably in junior high when I first learned about him. And he was always painted for me as a wild man, kind of like, a wild prophet out in the wilderness wearing a hair shirt and unshaven, that kind of a stereotype. We've inherited this wild caricature. Is it a caricature or was he that?
He was not a wild man. He was an extremist in his views on slavery, but that was the only thing that he was extreme about. One of the reasons that he comes across to us as this wild-looking character is that photography in those days was in its infancy, and it was pretty hard to capture nuance in somebody's expression, in somebody's face. The other thing is that by the time John Brown was old enough, was in a position in his life so that photography had become available, he had achieved a kind of renown, a notoriety. And there was a certain part of him that sort of needed to live up to his reputation. He was sometimes described by, sometimes his allies, sometimes his enemies, as being insane, crazy John Brown, he was often called. But he was definitely not insane. He had strong views, and he espoused them to extremes. But he was by no means insane. He certainly was always in touch with reality, although his actions would take him to places that most people wouldn't go.
Well, this is a figure who became something of a martyr, right? And there were people who agreed and disagreed. Even Frederick Douglass at one point was a little bit swayed by him, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So John Brown was an abolitionist. He hadn't been an abolitionist his whole life. And here I need to draw a distinction between people who were simply opposed to slavery, the thought that slavery was wrong, thought that slavery was bad policy, and who thought that it would be a good idea if slavery ended sooner or later. So we'll just call those the anti-slavery folks. The abolitionists thought that slavery was so wrong that it had to be ended right now, that slavery was an issue that was so evil and weighed so heavily, or should weigh so heavily, on the conscience of America, that it took priority over everything else. And John Brown fell in that camp. Now, the other star of my story, Abraham Lincoln, he was anti-slavery. He yielded nothing to John Brown in terms of his views about the wrongheadedness, the evil of slavery. But he didn't think that ending slavery took priority over everything else. For example, it didn't take priority over allowing the Union to fall apart. Lincoln took the position that slavery would end in the United States effectively only through constitutional means. John Brown said, Constitution, hell. You know, if the Constitution protects slavery, then I will tear up and burn the Constitution. Abraham Lincoln thought that was entirely wrong. He thought that it was wrong as a policy. He also thought it was wrong in terms of prioritizing the values that America stood for. Abraham Lincoln thought that the Constitution was the protector of American freedom. And he thought that if you could somehow free the slaves, but in doing so, destroy the Constitution, then the freedom that was left to the freedmen, the freed slaves, and everybody else would be in grave peril.
Was this really such a divide that there was a gap between the two positions? I mean, it sounds like it's a binary. Either you preserve the Constitution or you walk away from it to try to solve this problem.
Well, there was a great divide. So you talked in the setup about how people can be on the same side but differ over tactics. How do we get to the goal we share? And in the case of John Brown and Abraham Lincoln, they differed dramatically. They differed so dramatically, and this actually is fairly common in these kinds of differences of opinion, that Lincoln would say, if we follow your path, we'll never get there. And Brown said the same thing about Lincoln. You know, you moderates, you will never get us to freedom for the slaves. And Lincoln would say, well, neither will you. In fact, what you are doing is to, in effect, tighten the bonds upon the bondsman. So John Brown took his opposition to slavery, took his abolition to the extreme extent of believing that the goal justified almost any means, including the use of force, including murderous force against pro-slavery activists. And John Brown, in Kansas Territory in 1856, led a small band of his followers, including a couple of his sons, in a raid that resulted in the brutal death by hacking with broadswords of five pro-slavery settlers. And the point was, and these particular individuals had done nothing particularly wrong. They hadn't done anything illegal. They hadn't done anything particularly threatening to John Brown. But John Brown was sending a message to other potential pro-slavery settlers in Kansas Territory: you better stay out or this might happen to you.
So are we into this terrain where people will often talk about how the terminology tells you which camp you're on? One person's terrorist is the other person's freedom fighter.
The term terrorist wasn't commonly used then, nor freedom fighter, but that is exactly what was going on, because John Brown employed what anybody today would call terrorism, an act of violence that had a political purpose and was trying to convey a political statement, an act of violence against what amounted to non-combatants. So this wasn't a war. This wasn't organized military forces. So we would really, any sort of dictionary definition of terrorism would say John Brown was a terrorist. Now, on the other hand, his supporters said, no, slavery is so evil that it justifies almost anything, including the use of lethal force against those people who are trying to perpetrate or preserve slavery. I have to say that John Brown's supporters, and he had financial supporters. He was not a person of means, but there were folks on the anti-slavery side, on the abolitionist camp, who were willing to support him financially. They made a point of not asking him directly, did you do this? Did you commit the murders? And he made a point of not telling them exactly. Now, he had, and he was wanted for murder in Kansas Territory, but in those days, because, well, his photograph wasn't widely available, and he could grow out his beard or grow out his hair and change his name, and he was actually a pretty good actor when it came to passing himself off as somebody else. He roamed relatively freely, and he continued to get money from these, I call them armchair abolitionists, who were quite taken by John Brown because he had the courage of their convictions, and they knew they could never do this, but he was actually fighting the fight. But he deliberately dodged the question of had he actually done this, which suggests that, you know, there was a line that people in the abolitionist movement besides John Brown didn't want to cross, or at least didn't want to know if somebody else had crossed.
Now, it would be easy for us to talk about these two individuals without having any sense for how well known their names were in their day, contemporaneously, if people saw them as the zealot on the one hand and the emancipator, not with those terms, but in the public, in the newspapers and such, were people aware? You got a John Brown movement over here, and you have a more Abraham Lincoln, more moderate position over here. Was that seen that way in those times?
Well, not until fairly late in both of their lives. In fact, in the case of John Brown, not really until after his death. So John Brown was known to no one besides his family before he went to Kansas. And this is the mid-1850s. This was in response to the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened Kansas Territory, as I say, to competition between the pro-slavery settlers and the anti-slavery settlers. And there was fighting going on in Kansas. It gave rise to the term Bleeding Kansas. That was sometimes a bit of an exaggeration, but there was guerrilla warfare going on in Kansas between these different armed camps. And there was this brutal multiple murder, and the name John Brown was associated with that. But it's not like people in the East were reading newspapers and hearing about John Brown. Not at all. And so he was sometimes called Osawatomie Brown because he led anti-slavery forces in a so-called Battle of Osawatomie Creek. But you really had to be paying close attention to this. You had to be the equivalent of an extraordinary political junkie in those days to be aware that there was this guy, John Brown. Most of America had not heard him, did not hear about him until he led a raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia in 1859. And then got himself captured and tried and convicted and executed. And by the time of his execution, his name was well known because the country was already on this knife edge of concern about what was going to happen regarding the slavery issue. And Southern slave holders and the Southern white population in general lived in constant fear of a slave uprising. Because in parts of the South, the slaves greatly outnumber the whites. And if they could get their hands on weapons, then they might murder the whites in their beds. Well, this was exactly what John Brown was trying to do with the raid on Harper's Ferry. There was a federal arsenal full of weapons in Harper's Ferry. And the idea was to spread the weapons around among slaves in the vicinity. And so it made for great and lurid headlines in Southern newspapers that there was this guy named John Brown who was doing this. Thank heavens, the papers said, that he was captured and now he's been executed. But what really set the South on edge was when abolitionists in the North made a martyr out of John Brown, saying that he put his life on the line for this worthy cause and he has given up his life for this worthy cause. And you could imagine if in the United States after 9/11, if there were people who made heroes of the terrorists who killed thousands of Americans on 9/11, that was pretty much the response that the South, the white South, had to the adulation given John Brown after his attempt to foment a servile insurrection at Harper's Ferry.
We are visiting with H.W. Brands. He is author of The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. We're going to take a short break in our program and come right back to Bill Brands and talk a little bit about the respective childhoods of these two people, John Brown and Abe Lincoln. It seems that their fervor for the common cause, there's some commonalities there all the way back to when they were young. Stay tuned. Constant Wonder continues in a moment. thanks for joining with us today for Constant Wonder. We're learning about John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, abolition, and their divergent opinions, their views on how to proceed with this common cause. We have with us H.W. Brands. He is author of The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. Bill Brands, I do want to talk. I know we can't be armchair psychologists and really get into the heads. We can't psychoanalyze these people. But they have a common kind of background in their childhoods in terms of really developing a revulsion for slavery.
It's crucial that both of them grew up more or less on the border between slavery and freedom. So John Brown grew up in the southern part of Ohio. And Ohio was a free state, but it was right next door, across the Ohio River, from Kentucky. And so a lot of people who owned slaves in Kentucky would come across the border, and people from Ohio would go into Kentucky. And so John Brown sort of grew up understanding what slavery was. But there's a particular moment that he recollected when he understood more about what it really was. He was a young boy. He was only 8 or 9 years old. And he was playing with this black boy who happened to be a slave, but that didn't really mean much to John Brown. It didn't mean much to the boy as far as John Brown could tell. But they were playing for a while until the play came to an abrupt halt when an older man, a white man, who happens turned out was the owner of the slave boy, started yelling at him and beating him around the head. And John Brown could not figure out that the kid had done anything wrong. And he was aware that this man couldn't do this or wouldn't do this to him. So all of a sudden, there's this big difference between John Brown, a free white boy, and his playmate, this black slave boy. And John Brown remembered that. And he said, you know, there's something really wrong there. As John Brown got older, he became more aware of the difference between freedom and slavery. But he became sort of a mild abolitionist until there was one day in the 1830s when he got news, along with other people in Hudson, Ohio, where he was living, moved a bit farther north in Ohio. In Hudson, Ohio, was where news came that an abolitionist editor named Elijah Lovejoy had been murdered by a pro-slavery mob. And this seemed to be taking things way too far. Until that point, at least, there's a combination of things sort of internally to John Brown and externally to the developing abolitionist movement. And it prompted John Brown to stand up in his church in Hudson, Ohio, and say, from this point forward, I dedicate my life to the struggle against slavery. So John Brown makes this public statement, I'm against slavery. He didn't yet know what form the struggle against slavery would take, but he knew that he was going to be part of it. As for Abraham Lincoln, Lincoln was born in Kentucky, slave state. His family moved across the Ohio River, and he wound up in Springfield, Illinois. But Southern Illinois, like Southern Ohio, was commonly exposed to slavery, and Abraham Lincoln sort of knew what slavery was and what slaves went through. But Lincoln, too, had a moment of epiphany. And it came a little bit later. It was when he was a teenager. He was about 19 years old. And he was hired by a guy to float a flatboat with cargo on it down the Ohio River and down the Mississippi to New Orleans. And so he rowed the boat down the Mississippi to New Orleans. And for the first time, he saw a slave auction. And Lincoln, again, had known about slavery, but slaves did work and non-slave white people did work, and it didn't seem to be that different. But a slave auction, a place where people were bought and sold, were inspected and prodded and examined the way horses or cattle were prodded, this really opened Abraham Lincoln's eyes to what this institution was. And from that point forward, he had a deeper understanding of slavery than he had before.
I like these stories of formative experiences because, frankly, and maybe this is my own fault, I hadn't heard of Abe Lincoln being down in New Orleans. That's a long way from Springfield, and it's a world apart. We don't hear that very much, it seems to me. Am I wrong?
No, it's not that well known, but it actually brings up a crucial point. People in the United States didn't move around, didn't travel as much as people do today. And there certainly wasn't television, and there was no photography in Abraham Lincoln's childhood. And so people in the North simply had no personal exposure to slavery. Now, there were moments when fairly large numbers of Northerners would be exposed, when gold was discovered in California in 1848, and tens and then scores of thousands of people went west. They almost all went through Missouri, a slave state. And they would go through St. Louis, and they would see a slave auction in St. Louis, or they'd see the operation of slavery as they passed across the state of Missouri. So, but those were relatively rare moments. This is one of the reasons that slavery persisted in the South so long after it was abandoned in the North. So you could live your whole life in Massachusetts and be aware that, okay, there was slavery in this other part of the United States, but it had nothing to do with you, and you didn't have any personal exposure to it. But when people did visit, like Abraham Lincoln on that flatboat, and saw what it was like, then it really caused an emotional reaction.
Can you imagine that people may have lived in some semblance of denial about slavery?
Well, I think it's a bit like when people hear that there's a terrible civil war going on in Somalia or the Congo or some place far away. And actually, in our day and age, we don't even have the excuse of not seeing news footage of it. But if it's far away and it's not something you deal with on a daily basis, then you can put it out of your mind. And this actually, what I'm about to say, relates to one of the reasons that there was a civil war. People who lived in Maine often considered people who lived in Mississippi to be in a foreign country. I mean, to all intents and purposes, they were. They would never go to Maine. They'd never meet anybody from Maine or Mississippi, vice versa. And so, it's easy to be in denial of something that is inconvenient for you to do anything about, and that doesn't have any direct influence on your daily life.
Yeah, the out of sight, out of mind thing is understandable at some level. So this means that people like either the abolitionist or the anti-slavery movement or an Abraham Lincoln, they have to work doubly hard to even make the case for engagement.
Well, we see the phenomenon when police brutality is, people have known about police brutality for a long time, but once you catch it on video, once you see George Floyd, once the video is there, then all of a sudden has this huge influence. Well, something similar was going on sort of a retail one-by-one scale in the days of John Brown and Abraham Lincoln.
Now, Abraham Lincoln, in his efforts to espouse and prosecute a more moderate sort of approach to all of this, did he see real danger that there would be an escalation of violence? Was this part of his argument of let's be cautious, let's not do the John Brown thing, that's extreme? Was he trying to kind of thread a needle there by preventing people from going, kind of postal?
Yes. So Abraham Lincoln was opposed to the violence in Kansas, although the Kansas-Nebraska Act was what prompted Lincoln to return to politics. He'd been in politics in the 1840s. He got out of politics. He needed to make some money for his family. But he got into politics when the fighting broke out in Kansas. But he decried the violence because he thought it would be counterproductive. He thought that it would cause Southerners, white Southerners, simply to dig in their heels. And then the John Brown raid on Harper's Ferry, when he heard about this, he just groaned. He thought, oh, my gosh. Other members of the Republican Party are going to be blamed for this. The Republican Party was this new party. It was opposed to slavery, but not opposed to slavery, certainly in the John Brown sense. It took the position that the Constitution guaranteed the existence of slavery within the state where it existed. Lincoln said this again and again. He tried to reassure Southerners. If I'm elected president, I will do nothing about slavery in Virginia. Mississippi, the Carolinas, you can keep slaves forever. As far as I can do anything or the Constitution can do anything. Now, he hoped that they would be persuaded that it would be in their own self-interest to end slavery. But he said, I have no power over it. And when the John Brown affair came out, he thought, oh, my gosh, this is just going to make persuasion that much more difficult, because those Southerners will think that not only is their institution of slavery at risk, but their own lives might be at risk. How can you persuade somebody who feels that their very life is in danger?
So the turning point for him then came with secession?
Well, amid all of this, Abraham Lincoln is trying to get the Republican nomination for president in 1860 because the arithmetic of the Electoral College was such at that point that everybody knew whoever got the Republican nomination would be the next president. And he wanted to make sure that he didn't scare off people who thought that the election of whoever the Republican nominee would be would cause an immediate civil war. So Lincoln was the moderate who got the nomination. But there were hotheads in the South who were sufficiently determined to show that they couldn't be pushed around by the North and who had been threatening secession over a variety of issues for decades. They took Lincoln's election as their, in some cases, their reason, in other cases, simply their excuse for seceding. And most of them thought that the North wouldn't fight. In fact, strikingly, many of the abolitionists in the North had been saying the North should secede from the South. That way, the North would no longer have any moral responsibility for Southern slaves. It wouldn't do the Southern slaves one bit of good at all, but at least it would make the abolitionists feel better when they went to sleep at night.
Yeah, I'd never heard that before. That's remarkable. There's all kinds of political posturing to come up with what will seem to be honorable in the end.
Yeah, and the posturing is sometimes for political purposes. Sometimes it's simply to lessen the cognitive dissonance in one's head. And that cognitive dissonance between the promise of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, that's the charter of American freedom, and the practice of slavery within the American Republic. How do you live with that?
You know, one of the things that has come to my mind since getting to know about your book is and I didn't realize this before, that John Brown, terrorist / freedom fighter, as we've already discussed, he was admired. He was a martyr in the eyes of some, and that some included people like Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson. I mean, should I be surprised about that? I think of them as being certainly enthusiastic people, but not hotheads at that level.
No, they certainly weren't hotheads, but they were among that group of abolitionists who worried about the fact that they were really opposed to slavery, but they weren't doing anything about it. They were writing essays and they were giving speeches, but those essays and speeches were having no effect. John Brown, now here's a man, here's somebody who has the courage of his convictions. He is taking the fight to the South. And so they could vicariously join John Brown by applauding his efforts and by making him into a secular saint upon his execution.
I'm swimming in the details here, and it becomes more and more complex with so many different players that I inevitably come to the conclusion that there are more strands than I can follow. Because of all of these multiple strands, where do you think we go awry most frequently in sizing up the legacy of people like John Brown and Abraham Lincoln? I mean, even in your title, The Zealot and the Emancipator, it's kind of a binary. That sounds fair. I mean, you've made the argument for that. I'm just wondering if there are other players who were maybe somewhere in between.
Well, so a third character who doesn't quite make the title, because I don't give him such attention, is Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, a former slave, a very prominent abolitionist, he landed somewhere between John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. John Brown invited him, pleaded with him to join the raid on Harper's Ferry, saying this is going to lend credibility to the affair. It'll really make this thing work. But Frederick Douglass took the position, basically, he said, I'm a writer, not a fighter. And furthermore, he knew, having been a slave himself, he knew that most slaves in the vicinity, when they heard what John Brown was up to, would cover their heads and run the other direction, because they knew all that would happen if they tried to join John Brown was they would get themselves killed along with him. And so Douglass knew that this was going to be a fiasco, but he had to admire Brown's conviction, his devotion to the cause. As for Abraham Lincoln, he thought Frederick Douglass thought that Abraham Lincoln was too slow. Frederick Douglass was always pushing Abraham Lincoln, especially after Lincoln became president. You know, you need to make ending slavery, you need to make emancipation the priority. This is the reason for fighting the war. And Lincoln said, no, this is not the reason we're fighting the war. I'm fighting the war to preserve the Union. And Lincoln said publicly, he said, you know, my first job is to preserve the Union. If I could preserve the Union by freeing all the slaves, I'd do that. If I could preserve the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do that. If I could preserve the Union by freeing half of them and leaving the other half enslaved, I would do that. My job is to save the Union. Now, eventually, Lincoln became persuaded by the force of events and also by people like Frederick Douglass that saving the Union required freeing the slaves, or at least freeing the slaves in those states that were in rebellion against the Union. That's what the Emancipation was all about, the proclamation was all about. But Lincoln understood that that was a temporary fix. Slavery would be ended only when the Constitution was amended. Lincoln revered the Constitution. For him, the Constitution was more important than emancipation. Emancipation would come only under the authority of the Constitution.
And do you suppose that that's still a bitter pill for some people to swallow even today, that Abraham Lincoln held that view?
It is for those people who look to history to find simple, even simplistic answers that are applicable to present day problems. And it simply doesn't work because, as you noted, history is complicated. Life is complicated. And now, for somebody like me, the complications make history all the more fascinating. But it makes history frustrating for those people who want to reach back into the past and say, the Civil War was about this. Abraham Lincoln was that. John Brown was this. Because once you start to explain, then they realize, oh, wait, that's more complicated than I thought. Oh, darn, that's not what I was looking for. But if you really want to understand basically the way the world works, the way it worked then, and I would even say the way the world works now, the world today is no more or less complicated than it was then. But very often for political purposes, people try to simplify things because if you make things simple, then presumably you can mobilize people behind what you want. You know, if you say, well, on the other hand, well, if you're actually going to make something happen, you only get one hand. And it works better if you form it into a fist. But, you know, but to make things stick, to make changes that are permanent in a democracy, you can't simply coerce people. You have to persuade people. And this is why the South was forced to give up slavery by its defeat in the Civil War and the 13th Amendment. But the fact that the South wasn't persuaded meant that it took another century for black people in the South to get anything approaching equal rights. It was Lincoln's hope, his dream, that Southerners would be persuaded, absent a Civil War, to emancipate the slaves. And then they would have made the decision and they would have every reason to educate their workforce and bring these people in on something more approximating an equal basis.
So what I'm hearing you say is that ultimately he had to abandon a very idealistic view that that persuasion would work. And that must have been really hard for him to come to that conclusion, because that's finally abdicating one of his most precious positions.
Yeah. So this is another thing that's really important for people of our generation, 21st century, to bear in mind, that American democracy was an experiment. And it had reached a crucial stage in the 1860s with Southern secession. Because America had really only been a democracy, a functioning democracy, for about 30 years at that point, you know, where ordinary people could actually exercise political power. That's only a generation, and it was falling apart. And this is why Lincoln was so devoted to the Constitution, because he thought that the Constitution would guarantee the Union, and the Union would guarantee the future of democracy, would show the world that democracy could work. And Lincoln was gravely distressed that the Civil War had come on. Of course, he never called it a war. It was an insurrection. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons that nobody in the South was ever tried for treason, because treason is joining a foreign force in a war. So he was going to put down those people who were preventing the enforcement of federal laws. But yeah, as the war went on and as the casualty lists mounted, Lincoln was sorely distressed. If you look at the photographs of Lincoln over the course of the war,
right,
he appears to age 40 years. In 3.5-4 years of the war. And the moral weight of the war, I think, compelled Lincoln to turn toward religion in a way. Lincoln had never been particularly religious, but as the death toll mounted, he couldn't bear the emotional, the moral burden of saying, I'm responsible for this. He really took the position that God must have willed for this to happen, because otherwise there was no way he could live with himself. No one could sustain that kind of responsibility all by himself.
Bill, you tell it so well, and I just really appreciate your willingness to spend time with us to walk us through this. It is very complicated. It's just short of being Byzantine. I think I was able to follow it through for the most part. But I'm grateful to you for spending time to talk to us about John Brown and Abraham Lincoln today. Thank you.
My pleasure, Marcus.
Bill Brands, H.W. Brands, is a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin. We've been talking about his book, The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. We think we live in chaotic times, right? But those years building up to the U.S. Civil War, not to mention the war itself, they were just nuts. From Bleeding Kansas to Harper's Ferry, from the Lincoln-Douglas debates for a Senate seat to Lincoln's presidential election, all that time period. Well, when we come back from a short break, we're going to look at one of the wildest moments that nearly happened but was foiled at the last minute, the 1861 plot to assassinate Lincoln. Constant Wonder returns after this. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Long before John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln at Ford's Theater, actually even before Lincoln was inaugurated, there was another plot to kill Lincoln, which was foiled when the president-elect was sneaking his way through Baltimore to avoid his killers. Do you know the story? Well, it's a little-known episode, and it does highlight the tensions of the time. To learn more about this, I spoke with Josh Mensch, the co-author of The Lincoln Conspiracy, the secret plot to kill America's 16th president and why it failed.
It was the latter part of Abraham Lincoln's rather epic rail journey from Springfield, Illinois to Washington, D.C. to take the office of the presidency. He was leaving home. He was traveling with a large entourage, and he planned this rather elaborate 12-day rail tour through many northeastern states so he could stop in small towns and big cities, meet local politicians, speak in front of crowds, give speeches, attend dinners, what have you, sort of rally support for his new presidency. And this became a public itinerary. And at the time, there was enormous curiosity about Abraham Lincoln, this new president, because he wasn't really very well known. Also, of course, it was at a time of enormous turmoil in the country. It had been an extremely divisive election. The issue of slavery had just bitterly divided the country. So once he gets elected, he plans this elaborate rail journey to get to Washington, D.C. And it so happens the only way you could have gotten to Washington, D.C. by rail at that time was to go through Baltimore. Now, today, we don't think of Maryland as necessarily a southern state, but at the time, Maryland was a slave state. It was pro-southern. Baltimore had an active slave trading port. The sentiment in the city was very pro-slavery, very pro-southern, and very, very, very anti-Lincoln. And it was in the city of Baltimore that a band of conspirators who were loosely connected, a secret society known as the Knights of the Golden Circle, that's basically a pro-slavery secret society. These conspirators in Baltimore came up with a plan that they did not want Abraham Lincoln to be the president because he might threaten their institution of slavery. And so they came up with a scheme to kill him on his way to Washington, D.C. while he was passing through Baltimore. Alan Pinkerton, the private detective, snoops out this plot. He happened to be in Baltimore at the time, and eventually, after a complicated investigation, believes that it's a very serious plot, and he notifies Abraham Lincoln, and they have to come up with a plan B to avoid going through Baltimore when the conspirators are expecting him. The sort of scene you alluded to, with Abraham Lincoln on a train in the middle of the night with Alan Pinkerton and one of Pinkerton's agents and one of Lincoln's own bodyguards, Abraham Lincoln is in disguise, and it's because they are on a public train in the middle of the night taking sort of an alternate itinerary to get to Washington, D.C., to avoid going through the city when the conspirators expect them to go through the city.
There are a couple of women involved in this story, too, who are the first ones, I guess, to ferret out that there's a plot against Lincoln.
Well, one of Alan Pinkerton's closest associates was a woman by the name of Kate Warren. And she generally gets credit as the first ever detective, woman detective in American history. No official police forces were hiring women at that time. But one day she had heard about Alan Pinkerton's firm. And one day she wandered in off the street and said to Pinkerton, I want to work for you. And Pinkerton says, well, I'm sorry, we're not hiring any secretaries right now. And she says, at the age of 26, with no prior experience, I don't want to be a secretary. I want to be a detective. I've read about your firm, and I believe I could offer great services to you. And somehow she convinces him, and he goes ahead and hires her to be a private detective and trains her, and she becomes one of his best agents. And she is with Alan Pinkerton in Baltimore when he sniffs out this plot, and she kind of helps him investigate it. They both go undercover and are able to make connections with some of these secret society assassins who are planning this terrible crime. And she is also involved in contacting the Lincoln team as they're traveling. So she travels up to New York City to kind of meet with the team, and she's the first one to inform them in person about this assassination plot. So she plays quite an important role, and we found her just to be a fascinating character.
Before Lincoln arrives in Baltimore in disguise, by night, on train, he has already been in Philadelphia. In fact, he gives a speech there and makes allusion, not even a veiled allusion, to the idea that he might be assassinated. And I take it from your chronology of events that he knew about this plot when he was giving that speech.
Abraham Lincoln first learned of the plot to assassinate him just after midnight in Philadelphia in his hotel room. He had just had probably an 18-hour day traveling and giving speeches and attending events. And he's in a city where there are just throngs of people surrounding the hotels and on the streets because his arrival was, you know, a momentous occasion. And so it was a very chaotic moment, and he's just absolutely exhausted. And as he's about to finally go to bed in his hotel room, there's a knock on the door from one of his close associates saying, Abraham Lincoln, you absolutely must meet with someone right now. And that someone is Alan Pinkerton, the detective, who at that hour informs him that there is a plot to assassinate him in Baltimore in about 36 hours on his way to Washington, D.C. And Pinkerton's first idea is to have Lincoln get on a train literally that moment. They were just going to leave the hotel and get on a train. But Lincoln says, I cannot do that. And here's why I cannot do that, because in the morning here in Philadelphia, I am about to attend an incredibly important event. And it was a flag raising at Independence Hall, the site of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, to commemorate George Washington's birthday. And George Washington had been a personal hero of Abraham Lincoln's. But even beyond that, at a moment when the country is in crisis, the country is splitting apart, six states have already seceded, Lincoln knows that he absolutely must attend this event, because for him to skip out on it with a big crowd expecting him to raise this flag at Independence Hall, at the site of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, at a moment when the nation is in crisis, he just had to be there. So he shows up, and he gives an absolutely wonderful speech to the assembled crowd before he is to raise this flag. And at the end of the speech, he kind of loses himself for a moment, and he's talking about the values of liberty enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, and he sort of has this moment where he stops talking and he pauses, and he suddenly says, I would rather be assassinated right here on the spot than surrender those values. And no one in the crowd has any idea that only about 6 hours earlier, Lincoln had just heard that there was a plot to assassinate him. And so clearly it was on his mind, and he almost lets it slip that this idea that he could be assassinated is a real one. And the speech kind of went unnoticed because no one else knew, except for him, what he was referring to.
You mentioned earlier a bodyguard in his entourage, and this just reminds me of the security issues. Presidents back in the day, a lot of them were just sort of able to amble about on the streets and be free spirits, as it were. And I suppose in the time of war, that had changed by this time.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, when Abraham Lincoln was elected, this was, you know, just prior to the war. It was sort of the months leading up to the war. Between his election and his inauguration, the first six states seceded. There still had not been, you know, military activity, but there was certainly a looming threat of war. And from the moment he was elected, he began receiving death threats, far more than any president that had come before. It was unprecedented, and it was a direct result of the fact, of course, that the country was so bitterly divided, and it had been a very contentious election, and many in the South just wanted him killed. And so he began receiving a lot of death threats and warnings from credible sources that there were plots to kill him. But due to Lincoln's nature, he initially just did not take these threats seriously. He just was inclined to always see the good in people, and he just couldn't believe that someone would want to kill him before he had even taken the office. He kind of said to some of his friends and associates, you know, let them hate me after I do something as president, then they can hate me. But I haven't even done anything yet. You know, just give me a chance. But of course, you know, he was a sort of a kind-natured person. But his friends were very worried because these threats seemed real. And when it came time to plan his inaugural trip to Washington, D.C., a lot of his associates were very worried that his life was in danger on this trip, and some tried to convince him to travel with a large military entourage, but he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to send a kind of bellicose, militaristic signal to the country. He was trying to keep the country together, not to drive it apart. So he just refused to do that, and so he ended up with this kind of ragtag team of semi-bodyguards that he traveled with, a couple of retired soldiers, and one of his old friends who was a 300-pound kind of whiskey-slugging brawler who he had known in rural Illinois and who joined the inaugural journey. But he was not with a sophisticated set of bodyguards or Secret Service people, and so he was very much exposed on this trip to Washington, D.C. There were lots and lots of rumors and threats of armed bands literally taking over the city. And the authorities took these threats very, very seriously. And in fact, a congressional committee was formed specifically to investigate rumors and threats to, you know, take over the Capitol building, to basically mount an armed insurrection of Washington, D.C., and many folks in Washington, D.C. were on the side of the South, too. So there was kind of already a crowd there that would have been willing to join in any such movement. So it was a very tense time, and people took this threat very, very seriously. And in some ways, that threat is connected to this plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln, because it was some of the same activists in Baltimore who were responsible for kind of both potential plans.
Well, let's get back on the train and just briefly paint a picture of Lincoln in some sort of disguise. Kate Warren, I think, is with them. Alan Pinkerton is with them on the train. They take an earlier train and they slip on through. And how do they do it?
It's quite a remarkable feat. And most credit can go to Alan Pinkerton because he has to plan with very, very little time this incredibly convoluted and complicated alternate route to get Abraham Lincoln from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. Without anyone knowing that the itinerary has changed. So they basically have to secret him to Washington, D.C. from Philadelphia, and to do so involves four different rail lines, and no one can find out, because if anyone finds out, it will suddenly become bedlam, because the public will learn about it. And at this particular moment, when things are so tense already, it would have just been an absolute scandal and tragedy had the public learned that there was a plot to kill Lincoln. Not only that, but the conspirators would have learned that Lincoln was rerouting, and so they could have found some other way to get to him. So the whole thing had to be done in secret, and yet they had to take public trains in order to take this sort of alternate route from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. And so they come up with this plan to literally disguise the president-elect of the United States, who also happens to be 6'4", and one of the most instantly recognizable people in human history. And they put him in a disguise. Instead of wearing his traditional stovepipe hat that we all know, he wore kind of a low-brimmed felt hat. He wore a shawl, and he walked with a limp. And they all bought tickets under assumed names. And Kate Warren described him as her invalid brother. So there are a number of public passengers on this train, and Lincoln boards, and no one who is on this train, including the personnel of the train, have any idea that Abraham Lincoln, the president-elect, is on board with them as they travel through the night.
I really don't want to give too much away, but is there suddenly surprise in D.C. that he shows up?
Oh, everyone was absolutely stunned. No one had any idea. I think there were maybe two or three people that they had contacted in Washington, D.C. For example, his incoming Secretary of State, William Seward, knew, but only a few people knew that he was going to arrive a full half day earlier than planned. And it just because everyone was watching this moment and everyone was waiting for Lincoln to arrive, and things were so tense to begin with, it just was absolutely stunning that he did not follow the public itinerary that had been published. And because of an assassination threat, arrived almost a full day earlier.
Josh Mensch there. He's co-author of The Lincoln Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill America's 16th President and Why It Failed. Apparently, there was a huge controversy at the time about Lincoln having to sneak through Baltimore. But if this plot was as serious as it seems, maybe discretion was the better part of valor. We want you to stay with us here on Constant Wonder. We're going to round a bend in a very different story after the news. We're going to look at the curious past and the troubled present of the largest lake in California, a saltwater man-made accident, actually, the Salton Sea, and its story. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.